Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response day for the 20th of Adar. Let's begin by thanking Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hochhauser and the OU for putting these shiurim up online and make them available to you so we can share these Torah thoughts with each other. Let me also preface today by saying that I hope my voice sounds okay, but I haven't been feeling well for a little while. I haven't taped a shiur in a while. I taped the shiur in way in advance for exactly this reason, because I'm always worried that something will happen to me and I won't be able to tape them. So I think that I sound okay today, but if I don't and it sounds like I have a terrible cold, I apologize, and I'm sorry that you're going to have to listen to me, my voice, in this shape. An upside is that I am going fairly slowly because I'm hoping to track my voice and make sure to, you know, lubricate my throat as we go along. So perhaps I'll speak more slowly today, which is always an issue for me. Many years ago, when I taped some shiurim for the OU in the Nachyomi project, my first set of shiurim was in Melachim Aleph. And the first days that I taped, I had a terrible cold back then, and I did not realize how much it came out in my voice. And people years later would say to me, oh, I've started listening to you on the Nachyomi, and oh, you sounded so ill. So I hope that's not true today, and if it is, I apologize ahead of time. Feel free to let me know at grothst, G-R-O-T-H-S-T at gmail.com. Today, we're going to see two response of the Chatam Sofer. The truth is, it's only the second one, and it's long enough to take up our time here, but the first one is one that I found irresistible. It's a fairly brief responsum. It's Shut Chatam Sofer Chelek Aleph, Aura Chaim Siman Kuf Etzadi Aleph, the first volume in the Aura Chaim section of that volume, responsum number 191, and it's a fairly well-known tshuva, meaning it's one of those tshuvot that I would hear people say, oh, you know, everyone knows the Chasam Sofer holds X, which we'll get to. And it's a tshuva also, which it's also a responsum that can be applied to outside of areas that Chasam Sofer thought about. So that, for example, some of the people who are in favor of having a celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut and having being seen as a national holiday, or of Yom Yerushalayim and things like that, they will point to this tshuva, this response with Chatam Sofer, even though it's widely assumed, I think, that the Chatam Sofer would not have been a Zionist, not even like I don't know the right term for it. Today we call them Kardal, but I don't even mean that. But not even a moderate acceptor of Zionism, such as, let's say, in the time of when the state was developed. So I don't think anybody would say that Shlomo Zalman Auerbach or the Tzitzit Eliezer were Zionists, but they were people who were happy to work with the functionaries of the state to advance the causes of Torah as much as possible, and who were clear that these were excellent development. So even that, I think most people assume the Chatam Sofer would not have been that way. I'm not sure. The Chatam Sofer passed away in 1838, I think. So it's before any form of Zionism got off the ground, and it's before lots and lots of developments happened, and you never know how people are going to respond or turn out in various ways. But that being said, it's a tshuva, and it's dated. Sorry, the tshuva is dated actually the 15th of Adar. So today is a cheat day. It's a response to a letter from... No, it mentions in it that on the 20th of Adar, the people of Frankfurt, the Jews of Frankfurt am Main, the Frankfurt is on the Main River. There were two Frankfurts in Germany. So one was known as Frankfurt am Main, and the other was known as Frankfurt am Oder, depending on which river you were near. That's very similar to the idea that when we write kitten, when we write divorce documents, you always are required to place them near a river for these kinds of reasons. So the Frankfurt am Main Jews had a holiday on the 20th of Adar that the Chatam Sofer is going to mention, is going to refer to. So we'll get to that, but that's why I chose to put it in here, because 15th of Adar, I had already found a reason, a good tshuva for, and I did not want to lose a chance to learn this tshuva together. The question in the responsum is, can a community or an individual establish a holiday for themselves? Can they make a Yom Tov because of a miracle that happened to them? Meaning not to add to the Torah, but just to say, this is, for this year and in perpetuity, a day that we note and we celebrate because something great happened to us. One source for this idea is there's a tshuva in the Maharam Al-Ashkar, or Al-Shakar, depending how you pronounce his name, but he held that certain things happen to a community, they have to establish a holiday, and they have to establish it such that, and this is a very interesting question when it comes to Minhag in general, such that even those who move from that community have to celebrate that day. In other words, the Maharam Al-Ashkar is claiming that this is a Minhag that rests on the people. This will become a Minhag, become a holiday that rests upon, as an obligation, upon the people of the town, not upon the town itself. There are many minhagim that are a function of the town. If you move away from that place, then you don't have to keep that minhag anymore. But the Malam Alashka is saying, no, we want to establish this holiday in such a way that everybody has to keep it in their lives wherever they go. And he brings a proof from Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok, who was from the children and from the descendants of Senav ben Binyamin, who was one of those people who would donate the wood to the Beit HaMikdash to keep the fire on the Mizbeach, on the altar, going all the time. So this Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok would keep a day of a Yom Tov of Korban HaEtzim, on the day that they completed their donation of wood for that year, they would have a holiday. And he, Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok, was living after the Korban, after the destruction, and after he had moved to a new place. So theoretically, you would say, he moved to a new place, it's not his custom. So that's an example of a family custom that doesn't seem tied into the place. It's a custom that seems tied into the people. The Rabbi Malashka says, if a miracle happens to you, establish a holiday for it, that's a personal custom, it's not a place custom. And the Mogen Avraham paskins this whole idea in Shulchan Aruch. So the custom service, so you see that a community has the ability to establish something that will apply to them. And then he writes, and all those who join them, and that it can't be changed. So I have to say the join them part is kind of interesting. The Chatam Sofer is saying that he understands the Maharam Alashkar to be saying that this custom then becomes obligatory upon all the people living there forever and their descendants forever. But then Al HaNivayman would mean that, let's say I moved to that place after the fact. So that would be an interesting thing. Meaning when Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok does it, that's because it was always a familial custom. His family donated to the Beit HaMikdash, the wood, so when they completed that donation, they would have a celebration. That's a family celebration. On the other hand, we could also imagine a place has a custom, and all the people in that place, whether they were there when the custom arose or not, they would also have to do it. But now, the Chatam Sofer is understanding the Maharal Mashkar to say that it's both. You can have things that happen to both. That when a miracle happens to the members of a community, to a certain place, that they would establish a holiday for all those members of the community as people, such that they would have to keep that custom even after they move. He doesn't actually talk about descendants, but since it's being proven from Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzadok, you imagine he means their descendants as well, but then also anybody new who comes to that community. So I think that might be burning the candle at both ends, as it were. It could be you have customs that apply to people, it could be you have customs that apply to places. He hasn't quite proven that you have customs that apply both to the people who are there and the place as well, so that anybody who comes to the place has to keep it. Now, I will note that the Magen Avraham that Chatam Sofer referenced quotes Maharal Mashakar, and the language he uses there is Alehem v'alabayim acharehem, which sounds like it's all the people in that place. So I could have imagined that it would be the people who experience that miracle, they have to do it wherever they move to, and all the people who come to that place have to do it because the place has a celebration. In any case, let's move on to Chatam Sofer. He says, so you got communities like that, where they and their great Torah scholars will have a day that creates a miracle. And by the way, in the Maharal Mashakar, it's about making a separate Purim, is what they call it. The name you give a day like this is a Purim, because just like the Jews were saved in Purim from destruction, so if any community is saved, they will call it a Purim. So that's what it seems like. It seems like there's a possibility of creating a holiday, a Purim, to celebrate and to commemorate being saved from destruction. But the Pri Kadash in Or HaChaim has a kuntres at the end called the kuntres HaMinhagim that he established. We're not going to learn together, but that the Chatam Sofer is referencing. And he says, the meals you make on those days are sudot harishut. They're not mitzvah meals. They're not real celebrations of a holiday that you have the mitzvah obligation to establish. And that distinction between mitzvah holidays and sudot rishut is important, because halacha has as Jewish custom and tradition and law has a certain distaste for people who just make big parties for no good reason. So today it's all complicated questions as to what counts as no good reason. But sudot harishut is... it sounds like we're saying something that's just permissible rather than commanded. But sudot harishut in many contexts means meals that you choose to eat rather than meals that Hashem is excited about you eating. So, for example, somebody eats a meal in order to sustain themselves. Right? They need nutrition. That's not quite a sudot harishut. It's a sudot harishut because there's no particular obligation to eat it. But it wouldn't be called a sudot harishut, because it would mean a meal that you're eating for the purpose of being healthy. But sudot harishut are meals that one voluntarily eats for no good reason. So the Pri Kadash, when he says sudot harishut, just so we don't get lost in the terminology, he doesn't mean it's not a mitzvah. He does mean it's not a mitzvah. He doesn't just mean it's not a mitzvah. He means something worse than that. He means it's a conscious choice to eat a meal and have a party where there's no particular reason to have such a party. So how does he deal with Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok, who continued to have these sudot? So he points out the Pri Chadash that the Gemara refers to something called a Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit was, in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, there was a list of days in which various things had happened to the Jewish people that either would lead to a day when you would refrain from fasting was prohibited and eulogizing was prohibited. We still do some of that today. And in which people would have celebrations. So that Megillat Ta'anit, that collected gathering list of days in which things had happened, the Gemara already talks about it being batel. We no longer observe that. We only keep a few of those and not the whole at all. So since that's true, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, in Chaim Abed, says that according to the opinion that we no longer keep all the days of Megillat Ta'anit, he learns it or derives it from the fact that there are days that are supposed to be Tzomot that will one day be Susan or Simcha. We don't keep those fully anymore anyway, and therefore the Yamim Tovim that come out of them, we also don't keep. In other words, the Pri Chadash's claim was that if Megillat Ta'anit was Nivtela, then this whole idea of setting up new holidays to celebrate events that occur is not something that we do anymore. For the reason, same reason that Nitbatla Megillat Ta'anit, the Megillat Ta'anit was no longer put into practice, we have those things as well. Now that would sound like it's also prohibited to do it because then you have no reason to do it, and you're not allowed to, and there's no reason to add to the Torah in ways. If we don't allow such things, then we don't do such things. But the Chatam Sofer says, "Lofi anitati deleta lekol devarav." The whole thing is incorrect for various reasons that we don't need to get into. But he does point out the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, in that same Gemara, but a page later on Yutenovit Bet, says that yeah, but la megillat anid. Other than Chanukah and Purim. So they don't mean, the Balamor there says, and the Ran there says in the Torah, they don't mean Chanukah and Purim themselves, because everybody knows that Chanukah and Purim are still holidays. They meant that Chanukah and Purim, in terms of the Yudalit for regular cities, and 15 and Tedvav, and on the 15th of Adar, for cities that have a wall around them, and Megillat Ta'anit had said that, whatever, and then there's some things that go away, things that don't go away. But aside from all that, and there's much here that I skipped because I wanted to get to the other Shivani, gets technical and hard to transmit orally, he says, but it does seem to me that when, even aside, all of this aside, where he thought that the Chanukah and Purim examples meant there's room for us to put in celebration days if miracles happen to a particular community, he thinks also that when it says that Megillat Ta'anit went away, and the Gemara there says, and that's Shelo Lahosif, not to add anything to it, that's where the Pri Chadash said, see, you're not supposed to add to it, which means you're not allowed to add new days. Chatam Sofer says, and this becomes a Yom HaTzmaut issue as well, he says that's only days that are going to be allowed to the entire Jewish people. But a particular city or a particular state, it's not similar, and they certainly can do it. So that would be, for example, for those who want to oppose establishing a Yom HaTzmaut or Yom Yerushalayim, they could point to this part of the Chatam Sofer and see. Chatam Sofer, it's true, said that a city or a community can create a holiday to celebrate a salvation that happened to them, but not the entire Jewish people. Now, those who think that Yom HaTzmaut is a fine day to have would counter that it's a different thing, and that the Batlat Megillat Ta'anit, the time that Megillat Ta'anit got put away, maybe changes once the Jewish people start having entire miracles as a people, entire days of salvation as an entire people, then the entire people can have that celebration. Maybe. But that would be part of the discussion that we wouldn't have to have. But then he goes on to point out something else that also is an important part of the conversation. He says his understanding would be that these celebration days can only be in situations where there was an existential threat, where it was the salvation, the miracle that occurred, took Jews from mitah lechayim, from death to life. Meaning, let's say there was a threat that the local czar or governor, whoever it was going to exile the Jews, and then a miracle happened and he rescinded the decree. So that, the Chatam Sofer doesn't seem to think, would be sufficient for a Purim, for establishing a holiday, because that's not death to life. And how does he know it has to be death to life? He has to know because it has to be similar to Mordechai and Esther. What does that mean? Why does it have to be similar to Mordechai and Esther? Because the Gemara in Megillah, on Yedalet Ben Aleph, when it talks about how Mordechai and Esther knew that they could establish a Purim, that's, after all, the first holiday that's established after Hashem in the Torah. So all of a sudden, the Jews establish a lasting holiday. Mordechai and Esther and whoever's with them in establishing the holiday, they establish a lasting holiday that goes forever. How do they know how to do that? So the Gemara there says, Kal Vachomer. They drew an argument, a fortiori is the term in Latin for it. When you say, if something is true of X, which is less serious and less significant, it clearly must be true of Y, which is more serious and more significant. So What's the Gemara's reasoning? Me'avdut l'cherut omrim shira. When we went from slavery to freedom, which was when we left Egypt, we went from slavery to freedom. We sang a shira, we sang a song, we established a celebration. Mimita l'chayim, lo kol shekein, from death to life, all the more so. Now the thing about a kal v'chomer like that is that it only goes as far as it goes. Meaning, if I wanted to say, well, if from slavery to freedom they sang shira, from exile to getting to stay in my place, all the more so, that's a new kal v'chomer that I'm trying to suggest on my own. And I think the Chatam Sofer would say that we're not confident about establishing new kal v'chomers like that. And therefore, he says, as long as we're in galut, and this would be another Yom HaTzibut question, because I think some of the people in the Yom HaTzibut question would say this is the beginning of the end of our galut, because we're reestablishing a state in Israel. So that might be room to allow for a holiday even where it wasn't before. And he says, v'leka pidyon me'avdut l'chayrut. There's no celebration of having left slavery. And after slavery here doesn't mean slavery, it means being under the rule of, right? Avdut doesn't mean literal slavery. It means being under, because there in the Gemara, they talk about they were still slaves to Ahasuerus. And by slaves, they didn't mean slavery in the sense that we mean it. They meant that Ahasuerus was their political ruler, their political king, and they had to do what he said. So Avdut l'Chayrut means leaving the rule and the subjugation under a foreign power, and being able to be free like we want to be free. That's a whole discussion I think also you could have today about whether even the state of Israel, you could talk about whether it's completely free, because after all, if we just did what we wanted in the state of Israel, we'd have significant issues, because there are countries out there, particularly in the United States, that would have an argument, that would have a discussion with us about things that we do, and therefore one could talk about whether or not we're really completely free. But in any case, the Chatam Sofer is saying that as long as we're in exile, and therefore we haven't left Avdut l'Chayrut, then the only pieces that we know in that Gemara are slavery to freedom deserves Shira, because that's just like leaving Egypt. And that would be another argument for why Yom HaTzibut might be different and it might be allowed to. And Mita l'Chayim, death to life, allows for Shira, because that's the Kal v'Chomer in the Gemara. Other than that, though, you can't establish a Yom Tov, he says, because then you're adding, like the Megillah Tanit example says, you're not allowed to add. And the Sefer Yosef Ometz, which is an older, much older Sefer, said there was a miracle that happened in Frankfurt. Like I said, Frankfurt on Main happened on the 20th of Adar. So that's why we're reading it, we're discussing it today, because this is the responsible day for the 20th of Adar. And usually I don't do that, but I also don't always keep to my own rules. And they made a miracle, they made a holiday, a celebration for all their generations. Now, the interesting question is, based on that Maral Hashanah to begin with, does that mean that any Jew who ever lived in Frankfurt would have to keep that wherever they go? So I think that's an interesting question. But the Chatam Sofer says, and I saw my Rebbe, Reb Nosson Adler, who was the Rebbe of the Chatam Sofer and of other important Rabbanim. He's an example. There are many of them, but he's an example in Jewish history of a figure who was extremely important, extremely influential, and seems to have been an important Talmid Chacham, because he produces students who are then influential in the world and who leave behind them lots of writings showing their greatness, and they thought of him as very, very great, and yet we don't know very much about them because they didn't leave very much writings of their own. So the Chasam Sofer says that Reb Nosson Adler was born in Frankfurt am Main, and he kept this holiday, and so too we keep this holiday, even though Chatam Sofer is the Rav in Pressburg for most of his life. There's Shiva in Pressburg and Rav in Pressburg, which is far away from Frankfurt. We still keep it. Then he throws in the Rav Nosson Adler used to, however, say Tachanun on that day, not because it wasn't a holiday, but because he didn't, the Chatam Sofer thinks the reason was he didn't want to be Meshaneb Nehemachloket. He didn't want people to see him not saying Tachanun, and then they'd say, why are you not saying Tachanun? He would say, well, I'm from Frankfurt, and in Frankfurt we have a holiday today, and that would create, and I think this is an important example of where Machloket doesn't mean it would create strife, because there's no reason to think that anybody would like make a big fight with him with the fact that he wasn't saying Tachanun that day. It's possible, but I don't think it's likely. I think it means Jews shouldn't be doing other things in each other. We don't want to divide Jews from each other, even if they're going to do it with all the generosity of spirit in the world, and they're not going to fight about it. Nonetheless, we find that to be problematic, I think. Chatzalim then does add that he tries to be makbid to make a siyum on some sefer that day, so that the meal that he eats would certainly be a sudat mitzvah, regardless of this question. You don't have any doubt about it, and everybody should eat and be happy. So that's the Shua. It's written on the 15th of Adar of Tav Kuf Samach Hei, 1805. but it's about the date of 20th of Adar, which was a Purim for the people of Frankfurt on Main, and gets to the question of us establishing holidays to celebrate various things that occur, and as I said, which has, thank God, modern contemporary ramifications in terms of holidays that we've had the good fortune to experience. Now, the next tshuva that I wanted to do, and that took me actually longer than I had thought, so, and there's a temptation just to stop here, because I know I've gone over many, many times, but there is a, I'll do this briefly rather than getting into the back and forth about it, but Chashut Chatam Sofer, Perek Aleph, Volume 1, same volume in the Or HaChaim section, in response to number 3, talks about writing tefillin. It just raises a couple of issues that I think are worth knowing about. And the answer is the answer. The answer is you can write tefillin the way we write tefillin today, right? There's not a problem in the way we write tefillin today. But I think I think there's all these areas of Judaism that many of us never even remember to know about because they've been taken over by other people and they're handled by other people. So we don't have to think about it. So for example, what tefillin get written on? People probably know the answer is parchment. But what we don't realize necessarily is that the Gemara thought of parchment as having different forms. Because the Gemara thought that if you take the hide of an animal, which is where parchment is written on, there's the part of that hide that faces outwards. It would have, you know, hair or fur on it and skin. Then there's the part inside that faces the meat of the animal. But the Gemara actually thought that you would tend to split those in half, and the middle part there would also be stuff that could possibly be used for writing. So, the question that came to you from Krakow, from the Rav of Krakow, a man named Shaul Landau, was tefillin that were written on the klaf. So klaf is a hard word because there's the three things that we talk about in the Gemara are klaf, gilyon, and duchsustus. And that depends on which part of this the animal you're writing on, because there are three parts to be writing on that we're going to talk about. So this is written on parchment. Here by klaf, we just mean parchment. And they found that some of the words were written in a place where if you took a knife and you scratched away the words, there's some cloth there also that's sort of sticking up, meaning the hide wasn't as fully cleaned as you'd want it to be or as you'd expect it to be, or it usually is. And therefore, there's normally if I take a knife and I run it over, the cloth is the way we have it. It's all cloth, so I can scratch away. You know, if I scratch away the cloth, I'm going to make a hole in it. It's all one thing. But here, there was cloth that was raised up from it, and those words could have been cut off with a knife without affecting the rest of the cloth. So the Sofer said that that's because it was written on, and he writes, Al-me'at duchsustus ha-nishar. So he's using the word duchsustus to mean like fleshy kind of material that was left over, meaning you got the hide, and what you do is you scrape off all of the flesh, meaning if we're going to use the hide, we don't mean the part that faces outwards, we mean the part that faces inwards, but from the hide part that did face outwards. Meaning they would skin an animal, and then they would scrape away the hide, all of the stuff that was facing inwards, until they get to what they thought of as klaf. So the other material that they scraped off, they referred to that as duchsustus. So what he says is that whoever cleaned this hide in order to turn it into parchment didn't clean it as well as he should have. He left over some duchsustus. And the question is this Sefer Torah valid? Can you use it? Because was the parchment prepared properly enough? So the rabbi, this Rabbi Landau, was writing to the Chatam Sofer to find out. So the Chatam Sofer says, I want to talk a little about this whole sugya, which we're not going to do completely together, but he points out there's gvil, klaf, and duchsustus. He points out, we're in Shabbos as a discussion of it, Tosas and Shabbos, Rabbi Natam, as one view. The question is what these three things are. So Rabbi Natam's view and the Tosas' view is the klaf is the most outer part, and you write on the inside of it, meaning I skin an animal. The part that was originally what we would have called the skin of the animal, that becomes the back of the klaf. And I don't use it, I clean it off, but I don't use that to write on. I write on the inner part, right? The part that was in the animal's lifetime facing the skin. Duchsustus would be the other half, meaning if I took off the hide and I split it in half, and the assumption was that you could, and I don't know the hides of animals well enough to know this, but there was something that was considered the hide, I could split it in half, and then on the inner part, if I split it in half, the first half that would be the outer half would be the part we just spoke about. It would be the part that originally had the skin on it. Now you're going to write on the inner part. That would be the klaf. The duchsustas would be the other half of that exact hide, and I'd write on the inner, on the part that was facing outwards. That would be duchsustas. So it would be what comes out of a section of the hide that's still strong enough to be hide, not just random meat. And then I'd write on the inner part, on the outer part, on the part facing outwards, the part that would have been exactly facing what we call klaf. Now, gvil would be if I don't split it in half at all, and I just write on the inner part. So the Ran talks about the problem that today we don't split it in half anymore, and therefore it would seem like we're writing our tefillin on gvil, and the Gemara talks about the fact that gvil is not valid for tefillin, right? It gets complicated because the Gemara thinks that different kinds of parchment that we had, the klaf, which was when you split the hide in half, you write on the part that had been facing inwards. The duchsustus is when you split the hide in half, you write on the part that was facing outwards. And gvil is when you didn't split it in half, you just wrote on the part facing inwards. Now today, we don't split it in half, so you think that everything is gvil. Problem with that is that the Gemara is very clear that gvil is not valid for tefillin, so you get into problems. And it also seems like you can write on some things on one thing and on another thing. We don't want to get into that now, but it becomes a problem with all these kinds of things. So the Ran says, if you scrape away the duchsustus, meaning you don't split it in half, but you just scrape away the inner part that had been facing the flesh of the animal enough, that can qualify as klaf. So Adam Sofer points out this. It's not so clear what he means by that, because he doesn't seem to mean, you'd have to read it, and we're not going to do that now because we are coming to the end of our time, but it doesn't seem to mean that you completely scrape it away, because then it really turns it into klaf, not into gvil. And so it seems like you scrape away most of it, but it's good enough. So then there's other Rishonim that it brings up. The Sefer HaTumim pointed out that we don't today think that we know how to split these hides such that you get two halves, both of which can be written on. That's part of the reason why they did it, was to save, to be economical about it. Meaning if I split the hide in half and I get a klaf and a duchsustus, and I think the duchsustus was for writing mezuzah, which was not as significant an issue, you get two things out of the hide of the animal rather than just one. So that's part of the reason to do it. So the Sefer HaTumim already says we don't really feel like we know how to do that. So he says it depends on which side you choose to write on. If you just write on the front side that had been facing outwards originally, because that's the firmer side, that'll be called klaf. You choose to write on the side facing inwards, then you'll have to treat it as duchsustus, and he goes into it in those terms. And that's the way that he gets to it. So you have, this is the basic problem that we should have been trying to deal with. In a world in which we don't split the hide into two, what's defined as what? So the stuff goes back and forth that I really don't feel like I can communicate well, because it has to do with how much you actually scrape away and who holds what. But fundamentally, he thinks that to the extent that you took the hide and you don't split it, and you scrape away that first layer that had originally been facing the flesh, you'll have stuff left over that's fleshy, perhaps. You might have, but he doesn't think that passes it, and you'll be able to use that for all the purposes that we need to use parchment for, which is what we basically do today, is that we scrape it much better, I think, than they were talking about. But fundamentally, the idea is that we only use the hides for one. We don't split the hides two to use both sides. And then as long as we scrape away with that first top layer that was originally facing the flesh, then the meat, then we should be okay. And that is another responsible day for the 20th of Adar. This one is from the 20th of Adar of Kuf Tzadi Vav. Really tough Kuf Tzadi Vav, which was 1836. And that is a responsible day. With thanks to the OU, Rabbi Jacob Rahman, David Hochhauser, I bid you a good day.